Okay, everyone, so let's welcome back again. So let's continue on the suttas. What we're going to have a look at next, we're going to have a little bit of a look at the Buddha's life and the way, not the Buddha, but the Buddha to be before he became a Buddha, and to see how what he actually did and how he was able to find this middle way. Yeah, we've been looking at the idea of right view, and one of the basic ideas is the idea of the middle way. So when I look at how the Buddha to be found this middle way, how he was able to kind of negotiate the difficulties of life and find that opening, yeah, which is so hard to find, whereby you kind of find the end of suffering and all of that. It's actually, I don't know, I always find it very inspiring to read about the Buddha himself and how he practiced. It's almost like you're coming closer to the root teacher of Buddhism. You feel a sense of affinity, you understand what this person actually is, etc., etc. And one of the reasons that, you know, the Buddha does teach in this way, teach about his own life and about his own practice, one reason I think is precisely to make a little bit more of a connection in a sense. But also it is to remind us to say that this is how I practiced, and because I practiced in this way, I had success in this way, you should be doing the same thing. Yeah. That's basically what he's saying. And this is one of the reasons why it is so important to understand the Buddha in the right way, to understand the Buddha as a human being. If you don't see the Buddha as a human being, if the Buddha is something else, he's like, you know, I don't know, the, you know, something beyond humanity, the cosmic principle or whatever, kind of the later ideas of the Buddha, then the path he practices is kind of irrelevant to us, because, you know, we're not going to practice the same path if we are different types of beings or different types of entities. But if you see the Buddha as a human being, basically as us, and this is what he says, this is the message you get throughout the early suttas, then of course his practice is just an example for how we should practice. When he talks about his own life, it's not theoretical, it is a very immediate and direct practical implications for how we should also be practicing this path. So please remember that. There's lots of suttas. In the Majjhima Nikaya, there's about 10 suttas that are kind of autobiographical, where the Buddha talks about his own experiences. And if we read all of those in the right way, they become a beautiful inspiration for us to follow his example and practice in the same way. Yeah. So this is I have combined 3 suttas. And because all of these suttas are very closely related to each other, and I've kind of mashed them together into one. There's little markers to show where one sutta kind of takes over from the other one. You see the little square brackets there, and they show which sutta we are reading from at any particular time. So in case you want to retrace this later on in the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, you can do so. So I've done that out of courtesy for every one of you, so you have the opportunity to look at those things. One of the things about this sutta as well is that I have left in quite a bit of the kind of the surrounding narrative material, so to get a feeling for how the Buddha operates around the monks. It's actually quite nice. You get this feeling for how this all works. Yeah, it's quite touching in some ways. So this is how this sutta goes, starting out with Majjhima Nikaya 26, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the noble search is what that means. Already the title is quite inspiring here. So, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went into Savati for alms. Then a number of monks went to the Venerable Ananda and said to him, "Friend Ananda, it is long since we heard a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips. It would be good if we could hear such a talk, friend Ananda." "Then let the Venerable Ones go to the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage. Perhaps you will get to hear a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips." "Yes, friend," they replied. Then, when the Blessed One had wandered for alms in Savati and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he addressed the Venerable Ananda. Remember, Ananda was the Buddha's attendant, yeah? So that's why he would address him. Ananda, let us go to the eastern park, to the palace of Megara's mother, for the day is abiding. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Ananda replied. And the Blessed One went with Venerable Ananda to the eastern park, the palace of Megara's mother, for the day is abiding. So here you start to see all the various aspects of Savati. For those of you who have been to India, you have seen what Savati looks like. You can see the big ramparts, so the big kind of earth mounds, yeah, going around the city. They are there in the present day. The ancient Jeta Grove, where this sutta starts out, yeah, and with the Jeta Grove, it has been dug out. The ancient monastery is there. Some of these other places, I don't think they have been found, especially Ramaka's hermitage is very obscure. It's like ancient hermitage of some Brahmin, and nobody knows where that is. For good reasons. But this other place, the palace of Megara's mother, is another important monastery around Savati. And Megara's mother, of course, is Visakha. Yeah, Lady Visakha, the very famous female lay disciple of the Buddha. That's Megara's mother. And there's a long story found in the Dhammapada commentary, I think, that explains why she was called Megara's mother. And basically the reason was is because she, even though Megara was supposed to be her father-in-law, yeah, but she brought him to the Dhamma. So he called her his mother because he had brought him to the Dhamma to see things straight. It's quite a nice little story. Yeah? The father-in-law calls his daughter-in-law his mother because she has kind of brought him to the Dhamma. It's quite touching, nice story. Yeah? And so she was a very devout disciple, and this place in the Eastern Park, this was a house or something that she built specifically for the Sangha. Here it is called palace, and palace is actually, as far as I'm concerned, a mistranslation. The Pali word is pasada, and pasada means something like a stilt house. In those days, the good houses were built on stilts, yeah, so they would be above ground to avoid flooding. There was a lot of flooding in India, always had monsoon problems and all these kind of things, and also to avoid other things like pests, maybe wild animals, maybe thieves. There are many good reasons for building it high. And then when you went to sleep at night, you pull up the ladder, yes, nobody else can kind of get into your house. So it wasn't maybe like an early anti-theft device or something like that that they used. So that is Megara's palace in the Eastern Park. Yeah, you see all the various things around Savati. So next time, if you ever go to India again, then you can kind of think about these various places when you go there. It's so fascinating that when you actually go to India, these places still exist. Yeah, it really brings the suttas alive. It makes them real. It makes them historical. They don't sound like just fairy tales anymore. It makes them very tangible, the whole thing here. So he went there for the day's abiding. The day's abiding is just after going for alms round and having your meal, then you go to do your meditation practice, yeah? And the Buddha's meditation practice would often be just the Mahakaruna practice, the great compassion, which would be to, you know, to build up this compassion for the world, because he understood the suffering of beings, basically. Yeah? Anyway, so then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and addressed the Venerable Ananda. Ananda, let us go to the eastern bathing place to bathe. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the eastern bathing place to bathe. There was like a big river flowing past Savati, so that would be part of that. When he was finished, he came out of the water and stood in one robe, drying his limbs. Then the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage is nearby. That hermitage is agreeable and delightful. Venerable Sir, it would be good if the Blessed One went there out of compassion. The Blessed One consented in silence. So that's how you get someone to give a talk to the monks. That's how you put it, yeah? Now you know from the future. It has to be very roundabout, not too direct, yeah? And this is kind of, it was almost like Venerable Ananda tricking the Buddha a little bit to kind of, you know, to get there. it's kind of nice. It's very, very sweet the way it is put here. So then the Blessed One went to the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage. Now, on that occasion, a number of monks were sitting together in that hermitage discussing the Dhamma. The Blessed One stood outside the door, waiting for the discussion to end. When he knew that it was over, he coughed, knocked, and the monks opened the door for him. The Blessed One entered, sat down on a seat made ready, and addressed the monks thus, "For what discussion are you sitting together here now? And what was your discussion that was interrupted?" And this is another nice little thing. You think about the Buddha and you think this kind of, you know, magnificent person. And here he acts kind of with courtesy and kindness. He doesn't just kind of barge in because he's the Buddha and says, whatever. He stands outside, he waits for the discussion to finish. Then he coughs, to make his presence known, and then he knocks on the door. And this is a common way that monks do things in the present day. If you go to the hut of another monk, you often make your presence known by coughing outside. Ajahn Brahm is the master of coughing. If you, you come to at the mealtime in our monastery, when he's finished eating and he kind of wants to summon the upatak, the attendant, there's always one monk who is in attendance in Ajahn Brahm. He starts coughing kind of really over the top, and the top of the line, and then the upatak, and he kind of hurries over. So we actually use these kind of things even in the present day. But Ajahn Brahm always does it over the top, just to make fun and to kind of, you know what Ajahn Brahm is like. He's always having a good time. But it's very beautiful. The Buddha is not just because you are at the top of the hierarchy. It doesn't mean that you are impolite or that you have a sense of entitlement that you can do things differently. It's not like that. A person who is spiritually attained, they're actually quite humble. They don't have the sense of ego or that they are different or they can do things differently. It's very, very nice to see that. It's interesting, another thing that you see in the suttas, not right here, but you see it in other places, where the Buddha washes his own feet. He comes to a place, they set out water. It doesn't say that the monks wash the feet for the Buddha. He washes his own feet, according to the suttas. Now, these days, the monks, they often get their feet washed by other people. I do that myself sometimes. It's hard to avoid sometimes. You go Dhammaloka, you go arms round, and when you finish the arms round, two of the lay disciples there, they come and wash my feet. And sometimes I feel a bit, the Buddha didn't wash his own. The Buddha didn't do this. Should I? Is this appropriate? But I suppose it's just kind of become a custom, so you just do it. But the Buddha was actually quite humble, and this is kind of inspiring as well, and quite beautiful. So he asked them, "What is your discussion?" And they reply, "Venerable Sir, our discussion on the Dhamma that was interrupted was about the Blessed One himself. Then the Blessed One arrived. Good monks, it is fitting for you clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness to sit together to discuss the Dhamma. When you gather together, you should do either of two things, hold discussion on the Dhamma or maintain noble silence." Very interesting idea. And this idea of noble silence comes from. That silence, if you are silent with the right attitude, it is actually noble. And it's the same thing here, this is what we try to maintain during these retreats as well, the idea of noble silence. So the idea of noble silence is a silence that is natural, that is supportive of the path, not a silence that is kind of oppressive and you feel, oh no, I really want to talk, but I can't talk, or something like that. So if you really need to talk, then go to one side and do it, or talk to me or whatever else, or to the retreat leader or whatever. But the idea is a natural silence that makes you peaceful, makes you calm, makes you feel at ease. Then it is noble. If it is too much pressure on you and it doesn't feel natural, then it's not really noble silence. So find that kind of nice way where it's easy for you. You don't find it oppressive. If silence becomes oppressive, it becomes counterproductive. It doesn't really work anymore. So this is the ideal. I have to admit, monks don't always act like this. But that's kind of the ideal that we're trying to live up to. And then the Buddha goes on. And this now we're coming to the main part of the sutta, which is the idea of the noble search, the Arya Pariyesana. The Buddha says, there are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here, someone being himself or themselves subject to birth seeks what is also subject to birth. Being themselves subject to old age, they also seek what is subject to old age. Being themselves subject to illness, they seek what is also subject to illness. Being themselves subject to death, they seek what is also subject to death. Being themselves subject to sorrow, they seek what is also subject to sorrow. Being themselves subject to defilement, they seek what is also subject to defilement. Yeah, you can see the point here, and this is kind of what the Buddha starts to realize, is that, well, he realized that he has a problem in his own life. The problem in his own life are all these things which cause difficulties, that cause suffering, that, you know, you go into the world and you have enough problems with your own existence, you're going to have to put down this body eventually and all of this. And then you go out seeking all these other things that have exactly the same problem. And of course, in that seeking, when you seek these things, it is not just that you seek them, but when you gain them, you attach to them. That's what the seeking implies. So you attach to all these other things that are subject to exactly the same problem that you are. And what you are doing, you're just compounding the suffering. The problem is already big enough as it is, and now you go out and you seek it and you compound the suffering, you multiply it manifold by attaching to other things, by becoming involved, yeah, by getting married and having children and all of that. This is what from the Buddha's point of view, yeah, by owning all of these things and then expanding the problem in this way. So this idea, you know, that when the Buddha starts out on the path, The contemplation of illness, old age, and death is a very fundamental contemplation in the Buddha to be his own life. And there are other suttas, where he talks about exactly the same thing. That obviously was the main driving force that drove the Buddha to become an ascetic and to become a monk early on in his life. Yeah, this idea of death. Wait a minute, there's a problem here. Yeah, there's a serious problem. Can I just go on and do what everyone else does? Can I be a sheep that just follows along without thinking for myself? This is what the Buddha exactly is not. He's not a sheep. He's someone who has that independence to be able to look at the world through completely fresh eyes and has the confidence to do things differently. So that is, so remember that. So the contemplation on death, specifically, also old age and illness, these are very powerful contemplations. They lead you to some very drastic changes in your life. And this is what happened to the Buddha-to-be. This was the main thing that drove him forward. And what you will notice, and you will see this in a second, the kind of the standard idea in Buddhism, is that later ideas, is that the Buddha, the reason why he went forth was out of compassion for the whole world and all of these kind of things. Yeah, he wanted to kind of save all beings from suffering or whatever. But that is not what you find in the early suttas. It doesn't say that anywhere. It doesn't say that, yeah, all the beings are suffering, I'm going to help all the beings in the world. Nowhere does it say that. What the Buddha is seeking is a liberation from his own suffering. And when you think about it, it makes perfect sense, because how can you get other beings out of suffering when you haven't even found the solution yet? You don't know whether there is a solution. The Buddha is still fumbling around in darkness, trying to find the way for himself. So first of all, you have to find the solution. Then you can think about helping other people. That is the only rational sequence here. There's nothing in the early suttas about this bodhisattva idea about helping all beings. The Buddha goes forth to find a solution to a problem in his own life. Only then does he start to think about others. This is how he thinks. Yeah, very, very. This is the ignoble search, when you do searching for all those things that just compound the problem and makes things worse. What are these things that are subject to all this birth, old age, death, and all? What are these things that he's searching for? Wife and children, yeah, or if you like, husband and children. Men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses, mares, gold and silver. these acquisitions, these belongings, are subject to birth, old age, illness, death, sorrow, and defilement. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself or being themselves subject to birth, old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, seeks what is also subject to these things. So here the Buddha just to kind of spell out what these things mean, yeah? All the people in our life that are important to us, especially people that are our partners and children, close family members, obviously that is a very important part of the things that we are attached to and infatuated with. And all of these other things, it may sound a bit strange from a modern point of view, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs and all of this. But in those days, that was how your wealth was estimated, was in terms of how much cattle, especially how much cattle you have. Cattle was a very important estimator of a person's wealth. If you had a lot of cattle, you were a very wealthy person. These days, it isn't quite like that anymore. So it basically just refers to your wealth, yeah, your belongings, basically. And that is also clear there from the very last of these things, gold and silver. Yeah, jata rupa rajata, the very last one. And all of these things are subject to these things. So, of course, here, what most of these things are living beings, so it makes perfect sense to talk about birth, old age, illness, and death. Gold and silver is a little bit different, and not all of these terms apply because I have contracted the sutta a little bit. It kind of gives a slight, it's a bit misleading how I've contracted it. So not all of these terms apply to gold and silver. But some of them do. You know, like things like death, for example, actually is included there. Of course, in this case, it means metaphorical death in the sense that you lose it. Defilement. Also, it's subject to defilement in that gold, sometimes you cheat people by adding a bit of, you know, non-gold into the gold, and you hope they don't weigh it because then they will figure it out what's going on, that sort of stuff. So it's subject to that as well. But the main point here is that these things are unreliable. You can't count on them. They will disappear. They will eventually wear away and fall apart. And then eventually you're going to have to give it up. So they are subject to the same basic principles, the same laws of impermanence that you yourself is also is subject to. Okay. So that is the ignoble search. And what is the noble search? Here's someone being himself or themselves subject to birth, old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Having understood the danger in this, they seek freedom from birth, freedom from old age, freedom from sickness, freedom from death, freedom from sorrow, and freedom from defilement, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment. This is the noble search. So instead of multiplying the problem and making it worse, you actually seek for the solution for yourself. Yeah, this is what this is saying here. Again, this idea that you're trying to find a solution for yourself is what this is all about. The freedom from all of these things. The other English translation here doesn't actually say this. The other English translation usually says you seek the unborn, you seek the deathless. Yeah. But really, the context here makes it very clear that if death is the problem, what you are seeking is not some kind of deathless, some kind of state. What you are seeking is freedom from that death, freedom from all of these things. That is what you are seeking here. The Pali, literally, it actually means it has this kind of what is called a privative meaning, where you the prefix means that the original term is like negated. You're talking about the opposite of the previous terms, the liberation from these terms, death, illness, etc., etc. And the supreme security from bondage, yeah? This is bondage, to be bound to all of these things. You're bound to things that you don't want to be bound to. You're bound to suffering, quite literally. So you want to find the security, the liberation from being bonded to suffering. It's quite terrible, isn't it, to be bonded to suffering. You're tied to suffering, being drawn along by this rope around your neck, carrying you around from life to life, always suffering, and you don't know how to get out of it. You have no idea. And this is what the Buddha is discovering here. Yeah. And Nibbana, so Nibbana, again, extinguishment, yeah? In particular, in this case, of course, the Buddha doesn't really know yet what Nibbana is. It's just a word that he uses to think of the highest kind of liberation from samsara. He uses it in a kind of very general sense. It means like extinguishment here, in particular, of these particular things, suffering itself. This is the noble search, yeah? And it's kind of astonishing. It's kind of very brave and very... this is kind of the real superhero, yeah? Not the Marvel comics or the Marvel kind of movies. You know, sometimes I fly on planes and there's all these Marvel things playing everywhere. You can't avoid seeing them. I haven't actually seen them on the screen, but I see them in the airplane sometimes when I travel around the world, kind of superheroes flying through the air and this kind of stuff. This is the real superhero, yeah? The superhero who actually discovers something really profound, something really worthwhile. Imagine thinking like this, yeah? There is a problem in my life. There is death. I've got to do something about it. I'm going to leave everything behind, go into the forest and search for this. It's pretty astonishing. You've got to be, you know, you really got to have your act together to be able to do this kind of thing. So this is what the Buddha, what makes the Buddha so special, is that he is able to discover these things from scratch. Okay, so then now we come back to his, we continue with his biography, what happens next. Before my awakening, while I was still an unawakened being searching for awakening, the bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to old age, illness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I also sought all of these things. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth and subject to all of these other things, do I seek what is also subject to birth? Suppose that, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the freedom, the liberation from birth. Having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek freedom from birth, the supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. Suppose that being myself subject to old age, to sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in all of these things, I seek the freedom from all of these things, the supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. So this is the Buddha's thinking, yeah? And then what happens next? He goes forth, yeah? As I was saying, now his going forth happens as a consequence of that. He realizes that there is a problem, and now he's really going to set out and actually do something about this. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So, the Buddha to be, he was still young. Yeah, he still had the enough kind of physical vigor according to the tradition. He was 29 years old when he left the home life, which seems about right. Yeah, no gray hairs yet, black haired young man endowed with all the strength in prime of life. And then, of course, the little interesting passage there, that though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces. First of all, it's kind of nice to know that even the Buddha's mother and father didn't want want him to go forth. Yeah, nothing has changed. Everything is always the same. Yeah, now it is the same wherever you go. It was the same 2,500 years ago. So this is kind of an eternal thing, that parents don't really want the children to become monks and nuns. Yeah? So... If you don't want your children to become monks and nuns, or you are kind of struggling to free yourself from the grip of your parents, you know that you are having the same struggle that the Buddha had 2,500 years ago. But the interesting point here is that the traditional story of the Buddha, which almost everyone hears, if you have grown up in a traditional Buddhist country, the traditional story here is the Buddha leaving the house in the middle of the night, getting on the horse Kantaka, seeing his wife and child asleep, okay, and saying kind of goodbye, and then riding out of the city, the grand city of Kapalavatthu, and then kind of shaving off his hair in the forest later on. But that is not true. That is not what actually happened. That is completely contradictory to what you see here. And this is used sometimes by, you know, unscrupulous missionaries. There's a lot of missionaries in places like Sri Lanka, or there have been at least in the past, and you hear about these things, usually Christian missionaries. And they would go and they will say, you know, one of the arguments that they have been using, apparently, this is what I've been told anyway, is that they tell, you know, they go to people who are not all that educated about Buddhism, who know a few Jataka tales or whatever, maybe villagers who kind of have a fairly simple life far away, and they say, well, this Buddha of yours, you know, look at what he's doing. This is not right. He's kind of riding out in the middle of the night, kind of not caring about his wife and children, yeah? And just leaving everything behind without really doing anything. How can he do that? How can this person be considered compassionate? But of course, that isn't what actually happened, yeah? So once you start to know the suttas, you realize that some of these fairy tales that we hear are actually invented later on. They haven't got anything to do with the reality of what actually happened. Obviously, if his parents wished otherwise, he would have had to discuss it with them. He would have told them, actually, I would like to go forth. Otherwise, they wouldn't have a chance to express their wish. They wouldn't be crying, because how can you cry unless you've been told these things? So what obviously is happening here is that the Buddha has spoken to his family. He has spoken to presumably his wife and son, or his son was probably too small, and made sure that they were going to be looked after he left the home life. Yeah, it was a wealthy family, so probably there was no problem with that. So he would have set everything up in the right way. He's not as irresponsible as it is often made out And there is a good grounds for that. If you just kind of leave in the middle of the night without doing anything, it does seem a bit irresponsible. You've got to admit that. But that actually is not what happened according to the earliest suttas that we have, which is actually an interesting, a tiny little point, but it's still interesting because it changes the whole thing. Anyway, then he shaves off his hair and beard. He puts on not the ochre robes. Yeah, they're not really yellow. Ochre gives a better idea of what the color is like. Ochre is a kind of vast span of various colors, but kind of earthy yellows, reds, that kind of stuff. So he was basically a monk. Yeah, he dressed like a monk. He shaved off his hair and beard. So he was no different from later on the rest of the Bhikkhu Sangha. He looked like any other monk, really. And that is also clear from the suttas. And then he went forth from the home life into homelessness and became homelessness. Some people have pointed out that it sounds a bit strange, because these days homelessness means like somebody who lives in the city under a bridge somewhere in a cardboard box. That's homelessness. So somebody has suggested that better might be to live houselessness or something like that, move from home into houselessness or something, because it sounds a bit more kind of not so dodgy, perhaps. So it's a different, almost a different idea. It's a voluntary giving up rather than a living under a bridge, which often has all other kinds of causes. Often it's not voluntary at all. It's just that because of difficult situations, you ended up living on the street like that. Anyway, so then it goes on, having gone forth in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, another way of saying the supreme security from bondage, yeah, I went to Alara Kalama and said to him, Friend Kalama, I want to live the holy life in this teaching and training. Alara Kalama replied, The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma, this teaching, is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, realizing for himself through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma, as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of the teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see. And there were others who did likewise. So Alara Kalama was one of the famous kind of sages in those days. And as we shall see later on, he was a practitioner of samadhi meditation. So the Buddha goes out. And one of the interesting things here is that, again, it shows you the Buddha is not kind of full of himself and say, I'm going to find the solution by myself without relying on anyone else. First of all, he tries the existing teachings. He sees what is available in the world. And he tries that to gain a maximum amount of knowledge and understanding. And only when that turns out not to work does he seek his own way. He goes to teachers, first of all. First of these teachers being Alara Kalama. And Alara Kalama is mentioned in a few places in the suttas. So these are not literary figures. These are real historical figures, quite likely. And there is some good evidence that they actually were that. So these were probably like Brahmins, Brahmins who practiced the Brahmanical ideas of samadhi and these kind of things. That's the most likely likely background for a person like Alara Kalama. Remember, we were reading the Kalama Sutta the other day, the Kalama Sutta? Well, this Alara Kalama, he's called Kalama, so he's probably one of those Kalamas in the Kalama Sutta, And his given name is Alara. Anyway, so the Buddha goes to him, and then he learns his doctrine. And of course, the Buddha to be being obviously quite clever, he learns it very quickly, and then he thinks, I consider it is not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this teaching. Certainly, Alara Kalama abides knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him about this. And in reply, he declared the base of nothingness. The base of nothingness, or the sphere of nothingness, or the plane of nothingness. The akinshanayatana, can't even say it properly, something like that. And this is normally understood to be one of the immaterial attainments. That's what it normally is understood. Whether it actually is that or not is a little bit open to debate, but that it is how it is normally understood. So let's just assume it is that for now. But certainly it seems to be about samadhi meditation, one way or another. So he tells the Buddha to be about this state, And then, of course, the Buddha considers. I considered not only Alara Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. I, too, have faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Alara Kalama declares he enters upon and abides in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. And this was the passage, you may have caught it yesterday, somebody asked the question saying, well, the five spiritual faculties, that's what you have there, faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness, and wisdom. And the question was about these five spiritual faculties, and here we have that passage right there. So it already seems to have been available before the Buddha's time, before the Buddha started teaching. But one of the important points here is that in this context, it cannot mean the same thing as the five spiritual faculties meant after the Buddha became the Buddha. Once he becomes the Buddha, these have a very special meaning. It means specifically faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. There is no Buddha Dhamma Sangha. You can't have faith in that. The wisdom refers to the specific wisdom of seeing the arising and passing away of phenomena. Well, the Buddha to be hasn't seen that yet. So here, regardless of whether it actually does refer to a similar qualities or this has been expanded, that's what I was arguing yesterday, that the Chinese version may be more original. Regardless, it cannot really refer to those five spiritual faculties because they gain a very specific meaning later on. So I didn't mention that yesterday, but I think it's an important part of this. Anyway, the Buddha feels confident. He's a confident person. He's confident about his own abilities. Okay, then he sets out to gain the same thing. And then he says, I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, Friend Kalama, is it in this way that you declare that you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge? That is right, friend. And then the Buddha says, well, this is the way I do it too. Yeah, so in a sense, they have. So the Buddha has realized the same thing, or the Buddha to be. And then Alara Kalama says, it is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dhamma that I declare, I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon is the one that I enter upon. So you know the Dhamma that I know, and I know the Dhamma that you know. As I am, so you are. As you are, so I am. He goes on a little bit, doesn't he? Come, friend, let us now lead this community together. It's actually a very nice passage. I have to say, this is not. There's no spiritual pride there. There's no kind of, you know, what do you, you know, I'm the teacher. Yeah, you get, you know, get, you find, you know your place. Yeah, there's nothing like that at all. It is actually just welcoming. Wow, how wonderful it is that you have realized the same thing. Yeah, now, and then the kind of ultimate humility is that let's lead the community together. It's not like you have the pride of being the teacher or whatever. You put the person on the same level as you. It's very, very nice and very kind of. It's a really good example for how to do things in the right way. Even though Alara Kalama is not even a Buddhist at this point, he's obviously just a very inspiring teacher. That's basically what he is. So it's a nice little touch there, I find. Anyway, what happens then? Do you think the Buddha accepts that offer? It's tempting, yeah? It's tempting. Finally, you found this very profound teaching, deep samadhi. Yeah, it seems like perhaps you found the meaning of life. But this is what the Buddha thinks, the Buddha-to-be thinks. Thus, Alara Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with him and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to insight, to awakening, to extinguishment, but only to the reappearance in the a plane of nothingness. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. So this is how the Buddha to be thinks. Yeah, he has achieved something that almost nobody else achieves, a very profound state of samadhi, even if it isn't the full plane of nothingness, even if it is something else, obviously he has achieved something very profound. And the vast majority of people who get to that kind of samadhi state, they think, wow, this is it. I found the meaning of life. Yeah, this is what people tend to think. And that is how a lot of, this is what the Brahmanical idea basically is. You attain samadhi and then you have achieved what there is to achieve. Why? Because when you get to samadhi, all desires have gone. There's no drive anymore to do anything else because you have found in that state, you have found a complete satisfaction. You have found the meaning of life at that particular point. Yeah, you don't want to go anywhere else. There's nothing else more to do. There's no drive anymore. That means really you have attained achieved the meaning of life itself. But the Buddha-to-be, he is a bit more circumspect. He realized that these are temporary things. Okay, you get reborn in this realm, and then what? Yeah, where does it actually eventually lead you? And he understands that there is no guarantee here that this is permanent or it's going to last forever. Yes, it is very satisfying as long as it lasts, but actually, there must be something more. And this is kind of the genius of a spiritual seeker like the Buddha, that where everyone else would say, this is plenty good enough, they actually stop seeking anymore because what you have achieved is just already so mind-blowing. Just wait here. He actually investigates further and goes beyond that. And that is the kind of the unique ability of a Buddha to see very deeply. This is what makes the Buddha so special. So he is not satisfied with that. It doesn't lead to disenchantment. Nibbida literally means like the giving up, almost like the being repelled from the world, yeah, because you know that there is the world is to be repelled. Yeah, it's good to be repelled from the world because it's suffering. You want to get repelled by all of that. You want to be dispassionate about it, lose your interest in it, allow it all to cease, to find the ultimate peace and all of these kind of things. He already has a lot of clarity about what he's looking for. It's really amazing. When I think about it, I find it incredibly hard to understand how anyone can have that vision and understanding based on not really seeing the truth. Yeah, all he has is kind of his own wits to go by. It's quite astonishing, really. Anyway, so then he carries on. Yeah, then he seeks out another teacher. And in fact, if you read the suttas, there are other places where it says that he not only does he seek out Alara Kalama, and now this next one is Uddaka Ramaputta, he actually seeks out other teachers as well. So there seems to be a broader number of teachers that he actually uses. But these are the two main ones, and that's why he talks about them here. So, still in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Uddaka Ramaputta and said to him, "Friend, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and in this teaching and training." Uddaka Ramaputta replied, "The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, himself realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma. As far as mere reciting and rehearsal of his teachings went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see, and there were others who did likewise." So very similar to the previous one, yeah? So the same thing is repeated. And then Uddaka Ramaputta, he then declares the base or the plane of neither perception nor non-perception, which is kind of even more profound than the plane of nothingness. And then the Buddha-to-be considers very similarly as in the previous sutta. Not only Rama had these faculties, I too have them, yeah? So maybe I too should realize these things. And then I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. And then the amazing thing is that Uddaka Ramaputta says to him, "Come, friend, now lead this community." And there's a little thing which actually is quite interesting here, which you may have noticed if you are very sharp. And that the Buddha to me, he says, not only Rama had faith in all of these things, yeah? He does not say Uddaka Ramaputta, he says Rama. Why does he say Rama and not Uddaka Ramaputta? Well, Uddaka Ramaputta, Putta is son, so Ramaputta means the son of Rama. So when the Buddha uses the word Rama here, and throughout this sutta, Uddaka Ramaputta, he actually refers back to what probably was his teacher. If Uddaka Ramaputta is the son of Rama, Rama would have been his spiritual teacher, and he actually refers to Rama as attaining all of these things. Yeah, and that is why, at the very end, Uddaka Ramaputta is not the one who attained this profound state of liberation of the mind, it's actually his spiritual teacher who attained that. So when the Buddha-to-be attains the same thing, he has gone beyond Uddaka Ramaputta, and that is why he asks him to become the leader of the community. Never mind, it's not an important point, it's just that it's interesting. Why is it interesting? It's interesting because it is like a point which really has no bearing on what is going on. It has no bearing on the point of the sutta as such. It is just different people who are, you know, who have attained these things. If this was constructed, if somebody actually invented this as a tale or as a story, there is no reason why they would bring in a distinction between Rama and Uddaka Ramaputta. They would just have Uddaka Ramaputta going all the way through, yeah? And it would be in complete parallel to Alara Kalama before. But there's a slight little variation here. Instead of having a complete parallel, they make a distinction between Uddaka Ramaputta's teacher, who was Rama, and then the disciple Uddaka Ramaputta. And that the reason why that distinction is there, it can really only be explained that this must be rooted, quite likely, in some kind of historical reality. Otherwise, it makes absolutely no sense why it is there. And these little things like that, little kind of subtleties in the sutta, that was pointed out by a scholar, by the way, and this is why I know this. And he said this must refer to some historical reality, otherwise it makes no sense. And these are the kind of things that make the suttas come alive. You feel that they are historical documents because there are little incongruences like that throughout the suttas that are kind of weird and strange and make you feel that this actually is what happened. I'm pointing these things out, not because it is important from a Dhamma point of view, but just because it is interesting, more from a historical point of view, yeah? What actually happened in these things. So, again, then the Buddha to be reflects again. Thus, Uddaka Ramaputta, my companion in the holy life, placed me in the position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me that this Dhamma does not lead to repulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to insight, to awakening, to extinguishment, but only to the reappearance in the plane of neither perception nor non-perception. Not being satisfied with the Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. So now is the time. Yeah, the Buddha has left these things, and now is the time to kind of strike out on his own. He has tried a lot of what is already available, and now he's going to kind of try more of his own kind of practice. So this is then what happens next when he tries to find a solution to his predicament. Still in search of what is wholesome, seeking a supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived at Uruvela, at Sena Nigama. This is Bodh Gaya, yeah? This is the place which is now called Bodh Gaya in India, this place called Uruvela in the Magadhan country. Not so far from Rajagaha. If you have been to India, you know roughly how these things are here. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving of a clansman, a kind of nobleman intent on striving. So he travels around the countryside until he finds a place that is just suitable. And you will notice here, it's quite interesting, the suitable place for the Buddha is not a kind of just any old place, and it is very beautifully described here, yeah, with a beautiful river nearby. Of course, that would have been very useful for drinking and for bathing and that kind of stuff. And it is a beautiful grove. It is not just kind of a horrible place. And this is one of the things that you see throughout the suttas, how the noble ones, they always delight in nature. The delight in nature is not considered a sensual pleasure. It is considered something which calms you down and make you peaceful. Yeah, I'm sure you would all agree, it's actually quite nice to be here at Jhana Grove. One of the reasons is because the natural surroundings are naturally soothing and calm you down. Yeah, you feel peaceful. It's a very different feeling from living in the city here. Whether it's Perth or Singapore or Medan or wherever it is that you come from, yeah, it is a very different feeling to come into the forest. And even if you enjoy that forest, it doesn't lead to attachment in the same way that the sensual pleasures in the world do. And this, to me here, is like a sign of the middle way. The Buddha is already starting to find that middle way a little bit. He does practice austerities afterwards, so he hasn't found it completely yet, but he's beginning to find that middle way. And that middle way is that if you are in nature, it's perfectly okay if the place is delightful and beautiful and suitable and convenient, easy to get food and all of these kind of things, yeah? That is that middle way that the Buddha is starting to discover here. And of course, this is also the place where he does find his awakening. So quite literally, it is the place where he does discover the middle way. So it is kind of suitable that the place itself is a metaphor for the thing that he actually discovers. So then he will serve for striving. Now the striving part here is the worrisome part, yeah, because that kind of gives us some idea of what he is about to do later on. Okay, so maybe we should stop there because it's already getting a little bit late. I'm just concerned that if I start. We're moving on to a slightly different section now of this. So I think it's probably a good place to stop, and we can continue here again this afternoon. So okay, good. So we'll see you again. Have a nice lunch and keep on enjoying yourself, and we'll see you again back at 3 o'clock again later on.